And that is doubly interesting because we're talking about a book called More Perfect Unions, The American Search for, yes, Marital Bliss. It hasn't been huge news in Australia, but the newspapers of the US are abuzz with the sad news that a marriage once held up to be a paragon of compatibility, romantic love, stability, moral virtue has ended after 40 years. Former VP and almost president, he would have been, of course, if the Supreme Court had behaved themselves, Al Gore and his wife Tipper are getting a divorce. Now, lurking amid the articles on the Gore's 40-year itch and the rise of the silver divorce is a mild sense of shock and confusion. After all, the Clintons, whose marriage was frequently contrasted with the Gore's, are still married after decades of tumult and public humiliation. They're the ones everyone expected to get divorced. Now, in a country as obsessed with marriage and happiness as the United States, we keep coming back to America's obsession with happiness, but we haven't discussed marriage previously. The Gore divorce raises all sorts of questions about what makes marriages good, successful, or even perfect. And this is a subject my next guest has examined from an historical viewpoint. Rebecca Davis's book looks at the rise of marriage counselling in the 20th century and the role it played in shaping popular and political expectations of marriage. She puts it on the analyst's couch in much the same way as Tom Cruise put himself on Oprah Winfrey's couch when he was bouncing up and down, glorifying his most recent marriage. Rebecca joins us on the phone from Delaware. Did you know that Delaware meant bliss, Rebecca?
No, I didn't.
See, you come on a funny little radio program in Australia, and there's a reward for you. It's lovely to have you. Before we get started, would you explain the front end of the book title to a non-American audience? Because to us, unions mean trade unions, and they're rarely perfect.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. So the phrase "more perfect union" is in the preamble to the United States Constitution. So I was doing a bit of a play on words there, because the point I try to make in the book is that as Americans have been working and working toward getting more perfect marital unions, more perfect marriages, they've also been caught up in a really significant cultural shift in the 20th century into the 21st towards seeing that pursuit of marital happiness as being absolutely essential to who we are as a country, to who we are as a culture.
So you're saying that marriage, the relationship of marriage, is in some way metaphorical for the country in its totality?
Yes, and I think to a certain extent it always has been. From the earliest European arrivals in the United States, ministers used marriage as a metaphor for government. So that's old. There's a long tradition of that. What I'm talking about is this idea that not only marriages provide stability to the community and to who we are as a people, but that the marriages should be happy. And then, and what we see in the early 20th century are various self-described experts coming forward and saying, okay, I'm going to help you do that. I have this ability through the special knowledge I have, the special counseling skills that I have, to help you get to that place of marital happiness. That's important not only to you being a happy person, but is actually going to improve society.
You make powerful point about the dynamics of the relationships between men and women changing in the 1920s. Now, I don't know whether the name of Malcolm Muggeridge is familiar to you, the British writer who brought Mother Teresa to world attention, but he once told me that he'd lived through the 1960s with all its lasciviousness and naughtiness before in the 1920s. And you point out that this was a revolutionary time for women.
It really was, and it was a radical. There were radical shifts in relationships between men and women during the 1920s on a number of different fronts. I mean, most obviously in the United States, women achieved on a national level the right to vote. Women had been able to vote in some local elections, state elections in the United States, in some states earlier. But with the ratification of the 19th Amendment, suddenly all American women could vote, jury service became possible, so that changed. But also in the 1920s, more women go to college. More women get wage-earning work. A small fraction of married women who are getting married work, that starts to increase a little bit, too. That'll really go up in the 30s. But in the 20s, there's women's clothing change. It changes. It becomes more casual. Women cut their hairstyles, wear shorter hairstyles. More women smoke in public. More women are wearing cosmetics.
But there was an upsurge of openly stated sexuality, which even Hollywood in the pre-Hays days, you know, Hollywood films at the time were quite outrageous.
Yes, absolutely. So people said, even there was a quote from 1914 that the clock had struck 6 o'clock, and so even, you know, especially by the 1920s, there was this. For some, it was celebrated. For others, it was feared, this idea that sex was now everywhere. But most importantly, sex was everywhere in women's lives, not just in men's lives. In the 19th century, there had been a very openly sexual culture among single men who went out and gambled and went to prostitutes. But the idea that so-called respectable women would now be smoking and drinking and going out in the evenings unchaperoned.
You know, Rebecca, I hope you don't do any of these things.
Oh, absolutely.
That's very good. Now, I hadn't heard the term companionate marriage, and that emerges in the 20s.
Yes. Well, and the word emerges as among sociologists as a way of describing this new relationship. And it was actually kind of a technical term originally. What it meant in its basics was that, look, people could get, if you had means, if you could get to a doctor, or if you knew where to buy, you knew the right drugstore to go to, you could buy either legal or illegal contraceptives. And so people could get married without marriage automatically meaning for most couples the quick arrival of children.
Mm.
And also, divorce laws were loosening. In the United States, marriage and divorce are regulated state by state. We don't have national laws governing them. So more states were loosening their divorce laws. More judges were allowing divorces for more reasons. So this idea that, look, marriage is no longer about this bond where you have to stay together to raise your children and you have to stay together for life. It should be a companionship. And when the companionate aspect breaks down, people actually can leave each other in a legal way much more easily than they couldn't before.
Okay. Now, I understand that popular magazines started to offer lots of relationship advice, and oddly enough, so did social workers.
Yes.
Social workers play themselves in?
Well, there is... That all comes about in the 1930s, really, during the Great Depression in the United States. Social work agencies had grown out of voluntary charitable agencies in the United States, and social workers had been professionalizing and were really interested in doing counseling and doing therapy. Then 1929 came along, and suddenly they were just handing out rent assistance, blankets, food, whatever they could do to help the incredible poverty they were encountering. As soon, though, as the federal government, as our national government stepped in with the New Deal, with FDR's massive social welfare legislation in the 1930s, public welfare agencies came in, and those agencies started to take care of the nuts and bolts, the financial pieces. So over at these private social work agencies, social workers said, great, we can get back to doing counseling.
Mm.
Problem was, people didn't have a lot of money to pay for things like that. So social workers crafted this mix of saying, well, okay, yes, we can give you a little bit of rent assistance. We can give you some help getting shoes for your daughter, but we'd really like to talk to you about your marital problems because that, we think, is what's underneath these issues. You know, your husband deserted you, and yes, that's a financial burden for you now, but maybe if you could work out your relationship with him, he'd stick around, he'd be a better provider.
Well, you're talking about female social workers, and more in the 30s and 40s, who'd learnt a bit of Freud, hadn't they, as a part of their training.
Yeah.
So Freud's couch, which I was joking about, predated Oprah's couch in the discussion of marriage.
Absolutely. And one thing I just want to make clear is that when I'm talking about Freud, I'm talking about how Americans interpreted Freud. There's a vast gulf between what he actually said and how he was interpreted in the United States. It was sort of a bastardization of Freudian ideas in a lot of ways. So, for example, social work education in the United States in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and beyond was heavily influenced by Freudian ideas about sexuality and by interpreters of Freud. And social workers would learn these ideas in school, but then there were also people called psychiatric consultants who were often working for these agencies. And so once a week, every 2 weeks, once a month, the agency social workers would gather together for a seminar, and they would have, one worker would have written up ahead of time a summary of a case she'd been working on. People would read it, and the consultant would come in and say, okay, now here where you're seeing that this woman is frustrated with her job, I am seeing, you know, an unresolved whatever, or I'm seeing a latent homosexual this, or this woman is not adequately feminine.
Or she's emasculating her husband, etc. But as you...
And so over and over again, they were taught to see these marital conflicts through the psychiatric Freudian lens.
But as you point out, Freud was much more accommodating about the spectrum of acceptable sexual behavior.
Absolutely. But this was how, in the United States, that nuance in Freud's thinking was pretty much lost for a long time. And instead, there was this very oversimplified view of sexual maturity, that yes, there are bisexual aspects of every person, and we see this in children especially, but if you're mature, if you go on the right course, you outgrow that. So somebody who is both adult and expressing same-sex desire is emotionally immature, according to that kind of
thing. With the passing of time and more therapeutic intervention, we're looking at an increasingly middle-class white issue, are we not, rather than something in which African-Americans wouldn't be terribly interested.
Right, and that's one of the things that happens at these social work agencies. For one thing, African-Americans in the United States after World War II have a lot more to worry about in some ways, to be kind of blunt about it, than marriage counseling. They're worried about employment discrimination, housing discrimination. They're investing in the civil rights movement. So marriage counseling becomes really something that middle-class couples go after. And part of that goes back to what happened in the 30s with social work, people kind of feeling like social workers weren't listening to them. They were saying, no, my problems are economic, and social workers trying to say, no, but okay, yes, there's economics, but let's look at the emotional. And that turned off a lot of people.
Tell me this, Rebecca. When does divorce start to kick in as a social phenomenon?
Well, there's a big surge in the number of divorces right after World War II, and then it goes back down during the 1950s. By the mid late 1940s into the 1950s, the divorce rate is back down to levels it had been at in the 20s and 30s. But then it's in the late 60s, and then especially in the 1970s, the divorce rate in the U.S. really goes up rapidly.
The reason I raise that is because lost count of the programs we've done over the decades on therapy, particularly in the United States, which is so enthusiastic about it and all its manifestations.
Yeah.
And, of course, during all this time when people concentrate more and more and more on their own emotions and that of their families and partners, things seem to get progressively worse. You know, that, here we are, Alan Tipper, for heaven's sake. What a terrible news that is.
It is, yeah. Well, or maybe it isn't. It's all in the interpretation, I guess. I mean, one of the things that I found in my research that surprised me was how important the 1970s as a decade was to recommitting Americans to marriage. And that's ironic because the divorce rate is goes way up, and it sort of peaks in the early 1980s, and it's come down a little bit since then. And it's stereotyped as the me decade. Christopher Lash, a very famous cultural critic, wrote a book called The Culture of Narcissism about the 1970s, in large ways blaming women and feminism for this what he called narcissism. And in fact, what I found were just the proliferation of marriage-saving programs in the 1970s. And for the first time, marriage counseling that was really about getting both spouses into the counselor's office. For decades, marriage counseling had meant the wife went to see a social worker or a therapist.
Not the husband, just the missus.
Most of the time. Or the husband and wife would see two different counselors. And so it was this idea that these problems are personal. It came out of this Freudian mindset that if you want to figure out what's going on, you need to get deep into a person's, you know, subconscious, deal with childhood issues, neuroses. By the 70s, it became, can these two people actually hear each other when they speak? Do they speak the same language? How are they communicating? Is there empathy? And that was part of a move to say, I want to be more fulfilled in my marriage, and I need the partner to come along in order for that to happen. So ironically, this decade that's pilloried for being so self-absorbed was actually a watershed decade in recommitting Americans to trying to find happiness in their marriages. Of course, the divorce rate went up, too, because I think for a lot of couples, they tried it, and they came through it, and they said, you know what, it's just not there, and the world today gives me options that someone 50 years ago didn't have to say, I'm done.
Yeah, well,
and
look,
so is it a tragedy? I don't know.
I was joking about it, really. I think better a divorce than a really unpleasant or violent or just deeply unhappy marriage. This is LNL on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/RN. And my delightful guest is historian Rebecca Davis. Her book is More Perfect Unions, The American Search for Marital Bliss. You've had to read a lot of this stuff, vast amounts of it. Was it mainly tosh, or did you find a lot of good sense in what was being told to men and women?
I found a mix, of course. What surprised me was two things. One was how much the counseling, that even when only the wife went, how much a lot of these women got out of it from meeting week after week with their counselors. And they talked about everything under the sun. They needed someone to talk to. I mean, one of the reasons counselors say that their work has become necessary was that modern people had lost their communities. They no longer lived in kinship communities or felt part of a close-knit group. And I think to some extent that was really true. So on the one hand, I was surprised by just how relieved so many of these women were, even when the advice they got was advice that made me personally cringe a few times, more than a few times. The other thing that surprised me was how there was a guy named Paul Popenoe who's really smart.
Oh, I'm glad you remembered him. I'd forgotten about Popenoe.
Yeah. But, you know, when it came down to it, he was far more pragmatic in the advice he actually gave than what he put in print. In print, he was very, very clear that, you know, you should try to save marriage at any cost. He started the column in the Ladies Home Journal, Can This Marriage Be Saved? And the answer was always yes. In reality, he had cases where wives were frustrated, depressed, and he would encourage them, it's from the 1940s, to go get a job, to do some hard, you know, real serious volunteer work, to get out of the house, to find fulfillment apart from their husbands in order to save their marriages. In print, he was far more traditional about a wife's role and a husband's role. And so that surprised me, too, and I think that's the key to how marriage counseling in this country has changed.
I want to look now, as we...
What people were really saying.
We don't have a huge amount of time. I want to look now at the role of the secular versus the religious. You're talking to a nation which is much more agnostic than your own. We have none of the, or very little of that passionate religiosity. And I remember that under Bush, a great deal of money was spent on a healthy marriage initiative, which was obviously him trying to placate, you know, his fundamentalist followers. But we're talking largely about a secular industry of marriage counselling. How did the churches respond over these decades?
Well, ministers, rabbis, priests have been very involved in marriage counseling since at least the 1940s, particularly premarital counseling, since clergy perform, some estimates say, about three-quarters of the marriages since the 1940s. So they have an opportunity, they have a captive audience for doing premarital counseling. And clergy were really open to using whatever tools were at their disposal to try to keep couples together. And obviously, Catholic priests had more of a concern about teaching couples to not use birth control and to really prevent divorce. Other religious groups had different agendas. But we see in the 1970s, with the resurgence of the new Christian right in the United States, this a very powerful pro-marriage voice coming together that then, over the 80s and into the 90s and into the 21st century, has profoundly shaped public policy about marriage. And so we now, actually still now under Obama, the Healthy Marriage Initiative is still funded through
You're
the end
kidding.
Of this year.
I would have thought he would have folded that up very quickly.
Actually, President Obama is supportive of what are called sort of responsible fatherhood initiatives. He is far more traditionalist or conservative, however you want to phrase it, than a lot of people might imagine about issues of marriage. He's waffled a little bit about gay marriage, and he just tried to avoid talking about it too much, so he is supportive of gay rights. But the Healthy Marriage Initiative is still funded. I don't know what its future will be, whether it'll get renewed or not.
You mentioned gay marriage, and of course that's a vast debate across your country. And it's odd, isn't it, that many of the people who are most passionate about the virtues of marriage don't want it applied to gay relationships.
Yes. And I think that has a lot to do with the investments that those people themselves have made in more traditional ideas about gender and sexuality. And I think when you have made sacrifices about who you will be as a person based upon what you understand you should be because of your gender, it's, I think, emotionally harder to accept a marriage in which no one of your gender is represented, no one with your sex is represented. So I think that's part of it. And I also just think that this idea that marriage counselors have taught us that we have a stake in other people's marriages, other marriages affect us.
Rebecca, I've got to wind it.
That would threaten my marriage.
I've got to wind it up. We're out of time, but thank you very much. More Perfect Unions, The American Search for Marital Bliss, published by Harvard University Press. Time to thank the team. Good on you, Luke Purse, Chris Short, Sasha Fegan. And Ratha Slee is leaving us, and I wish she wasn't. There's a lot of producers who've been charging out the door lately. Was it something I said? And thank you to exec producer Kate McDonald. On our next, it's classic, not Arthur versus Martha, but two Arthurs, Arthur the King and my lifelong hero, Arthur Miller. Radio National's news coming up. Talk to you later.